KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. You've all heard we can expect the big one anytime, a mega earthquake that will change the Puget Sound region as we know it. Seattle Times science writer Sandy Doughton joins us this hour to tell us a little bit more. The Army Corps of Engineers made a major announcement this morning about coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. Our environmental reporter Ashley Ahern of EarthFix is here to tell us more. Thanks for coming in. The announcement, what was it?
So the Army Corps announced essentially that they are not going to consider climate change in the review of the proposed coal export terminals in the Northwest, and they are also not going to conduct an area-wide impact assessment or that would take into consideration the impacts around the whole region of the three proposed coal export terminals, as opposed to considering them on a one-by-one individual basis. This was something that many environmental groups had called for, was to consider them holistically as opposed to individually.
So what does this mean in practical terms?
It means that basically the Army Corps has started doing the review process for the largest terminal, Gateway Pacific. They'll continue to do that terminal review independently. So they're going to be looking at the specific impacts around the site of the terminal itself, as opposed to looking at the impacts for communities all along the rail lines and the big gorilla in the room, the climate change. Question.
Where did they make this announcement?
They announced it before the House of Representatives, a subcommittee on energy and power. And the title of this committee, they were tasked with answering the question of what are the regulatory, market, and legal barriers to export. So they were talking about natural gas and coal, to be specific. And Mayor McGinn will also be testifying, and he probably pretty soon now.
Not everybody on this panel was happy with the Army Corps announcement, I understand.
Yes. We have some tape recorded this morning. Henry Waxman, a representative from California, as you know, basically said he thinks the Army Corps is making a big mistake. So we're going to hear from Jennifer Moyers. Jennifer Moyer is the head of regulatory program for the Army Corps.
My question to you is, how can you conclude that exporting coal to China does not contribute to climate change if you even refuse to look at this issue?
I would say that the Corps' responsibilities and authorities with respect to our civil works program are dramatically different from the regulatory framework that governs our work within the framework that we're looking at these proposals. These issues are not part of this Corps' scope of analysis. The burning of the coal in Asia, although very important aspects to look at, they're not part of our framework. They're not within our scope of analysis. And they're too far attenuated to be considered indirect effects of
I think you should reconsider your position. There's no bigger threat to navigable waters than climate change. Scientists tell us that those impacts will include sea level rise, more intense storms, increased flooding. Those impacts will all adversely affect navigable waters. It's the responsibility of the Corps of Engineers to protect the nation's navigable waters. The Corps cannot meet its responsibility by ignoring these climate impacts. Before billions of dollars are spent building new coal export facilities, we need to understand the impacts of those exports, including the climate impacts of burning all of that coal.
To be fair, the Army Corps, what she's saying there is correct. I mean, under the National Environmental Policy Act or Protection Act, by law, that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to conduct the review of navigable waters. What would the impacts be to those navigable waters?
So right by the terminals themselves. I mean, obviously, Congress has oversight of many things. Does it have oversight over the final decision about whether trains or terminals will be opened?
No, the Army Corps will be making that final decision. But in this situation, they're sort of becoming the whipping boy or whipping girl in this instance for a question that's playing out at much higher levels. The White House itself is thinking about coal and the climate change question, and we're expecting some policy announcements from the president in the coming month actually about that. But whether or not there's going to be any sort of holistic or national approach to the climate change impacts of our energy exports as a nation, that's the big picture question here. And so the Army Corps testifying in this subcommittee is sort of, you know, one stop on the road and arguably really just taking the hit for some bigger questions that are not getting answered right now.
This, as you mentioned, was a larger hearing, not specifically about these terminals themselves. What is the timeline now after this Army Corps announcement?
The timeline will proceed as it's already begun. The hearings, or the Army Corps is about to announce the scope for the environmental review for the Gateway Pacific Terminal, and then they'll start putting together the report, and with the help of the consultant they've hired to do that. And they've also started the pre-scoping process. Basically, that's where they say, what are we going to consider in this review? Well, now we know it's not going to include climate change. So that's also begun for the Millennium Bulk Terminal, which is the second largest terminal proposed for near Longview, Washington.
Ashley Ahern is KOW's environmental reporter, part of the partnership called EarthFix. She's been covering the whole coal train and coal terminal issue for months now, and I'm sure for months to come. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:12. If you're caught in a music listening rut, stick around. We're going to bust you right out of that rut in a minute. But first, how does your knowledge grow? Through KUOW, of course. You listen to public radio because it nurtures your knowledge every day by digging deep into issues that are important to you. And it's your support that makes it all possible. Right now is a great time to renew your annual KUOW membership or make a special gift. Please mail your gift in or go online to kuow.org. by June 30. And thanks. 59 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. Chance of showers today, maybe a thunderstorm later, and a high of 71. It's 9:13. There's going to be a huge earthquake here in the Pacific Northwest, amazingly powerful and destructive, and it could hit any time. We'll find out what scientists know about our next big earthquake in about 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. If you've been getting a bit tired of your music playlist, time to listen up. Each Tuesday and weekday, we've been asking music writers in our region to come in to share something new with us. And today we welcome back composer and classical music writer Gavin Borchardt. Gavin, a couple of weeks ago, you turned us on to a fantastic piano voice collaboration, mm-hmm. and today it's like a one-woman band, Hope Weshkin.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's similar in that what Hope Weshkin does is, in a way, kind of a classical folk music kind of hybrid. She actually is a doctor here in Seattle.
She's a physician doctor?
A physician doctor.
Oh.
Yeah, that's her day job, but as well as being a soprano and a violinist and composer. And it's this the last three roles that you will hear on this CD called Leaning Toward the Fiddler, which came out earlier this year. And it's an album of a number of her folk song arrangements, most of them Eastern European in origin. And she sings and accompanies herself on the violin at the same time.
I'm not sure if we have anything queued up. Do we have something? Yes. Let's hear a little music from Hope Weshkin. Music from Hope Weshkin. And Gavin Borchardt, I feel like I'm hearing more than one violin in there.
No. It's just herself. And I don't even think she does any multi-tracking.
No, this
I don't
is
believe.
Just
the... I think it's her and her violin and a microphone.
Wow.
As far as I know. But yeah, with the double stops and playing in more than one string at a time, you can get this kind of choral effect. And when you blend that with her voice, I mean, it creates this really wonderful resonance that, yes, it sounds like there's more going on than there is.
It surely does. You mentioned Eastern European. We have a lot of sort of Slovenian, Croatian folk singers in mm-hmm. this area. Mm-hmm. And that music really reminiscent of that same
Yeah,
sound.
Exactly. I believe it's a Bulgarian folk song, she says here in the program notes. I suppose I should try. Should I try pronouncing
try to pronounce
the final?
It. You do it.
Polegnala e Tudora. I don't know. My Bulgarian is a little rusty. But yes, anyways, it's a folk song that she has kind of arranged for herself and her voice. And it's a really gorgeous track.
That voice is very crystal and pure. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. She's a trained soprano.
Yes.
And
studied here in Seattle, I think, with Tomasa Eckert, who was at Cornish for a long time.
And, yeah.
a name you probably know.
An interesting thing. I know that she had an album that came out probably about 5 years ago now, 2008 or 2009, if I'm not mistaken, called Charisma, which did have a lot more instrumentation on it.
Yeah, but again, it was all her. I mean, this is one-woman opera that she did that actually drew on...
Oh, wait, a one-woman opera?
One-woman opera. Not just an album, but actually a stage show that she had done that drew on her other role as a doctor. And she plays a number of different characters who are in a hospital. One central woman, and then a number of the various characters that she meets in the hospital, other doctors, nurses, etc. And it's slightly satirical, but it's a really kind of moving exploration of the medical field and what it's like to be involved with that.
So leaning toward the fiddler is a completely different track for her. Let's hear another track of music from Hope Weshkin.
That was the year the music-making men toured the neighborhoods showing off their lovely hands. That was the year the music-making men toured the neighborhoods showing off.
So this, at least it's in English, you can probably say the title for
us. A Joyful Time is the name of this track. And it's a setting that Hope herself wrote of a poem by Lisa Sitkin, who is a poet who was kind of imagining her grandmother's reminiscences of growing up on the Lower East Side of New York. So again, it's this kind of Eastern European origin, but it's Hope's own original composition based on this poem, written for herself and her own violin to accompany.
You know, I'm not sure, is this even a genre of music? Because it really doesn't fit anything that I can describe except beautiful, beautiful.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the tradition of singer-guitarist is, obvious. But to accompany yourself on a different instrument, an instrument that isn't a guitar and isn't a piano, is really unique as far as I know. And the fact that Hope has done this so extensively, not only on the CD, but then in this stage show that she did... she's really kind of pioneering in that way, I think. She's taking this idea of accompanying herself and using an instrument that you wouldn't necessarily associate with that tradition.
Well, I wouldn't imagine that you could actually sing while playing fiddle at the same time because your head is kind of tucked in. Am I wrong about that? I mean,
she manages somehow. I mean, it would be easier than, singing and playing the flute at the same time.
Yes,
example.
Because your mouth would be tied up. But, when you sort of need your neck to have that sound come out.
She may have some kind of special shoulder rest
that doesn't require
her to twist around her throat. Yeah, exactly.
When did you discover Hope Weshkin's music?
Actually, I've known Hope for some time and have collaborated with her on some of my own stuff. And she's a wonderful soprano. She's a great friend to contemporary music and to composers in Seattle and has performed here and there in that capacity. And she's wonderful to work with. And to hear her then branch out and do her own disc and, where she plays all the roles herself, I think it's really amazing. I think it's a great, great achievement, and I think it's a fascinating CD.
Will she? I know she's performed, as you mentioned, part of Charisma, and I know she played maybe back in March or April when the CD was first.
She had a kind of a CD release event. Yeah, exactly.
Does she play live around town?
Not too much.
Because she's busy curing people.
Exactly.
As a physician.
And, being a wife and mother and all that stuff, too. So it's a little tricky to get out there and be a full-time gigging sort of club musician. But, I hope that we get more chances to hear her live here in Seattle.
Who did she release this recording herself? Do people release recordings anymore?
Ravello Records is the name of the label. I think it's a local label. I'm not entirely sure.
But where would one find this?
Online? On Amazon. Yeah.
On Amazon.
Just Google the title Leaning Toward the Fiddler or Hope Weshkin and it'll come up.
One thing I'm thinking, Gavin, that we're building this new genre of like intimate singing accompanied by classical instruments, and I'm sure in the you know, there's a lot of room online to divide music up in that way. But are there musicians in other parts of the country that are following these paths, or is this something unique to our region?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, I don't know offhand if anyone else is doing something like this. Really, I mean, as far as the self-accompaniment. I mean, certainly there are people who kind of explore this realm of folk music that kind of overlaps with Americana and roots music and the classical repertory and that sort of thing. I mean, there are people who do that. But as far as violinists / singers, I really don't know of any.
No, the only other one I can think of right offhand is Robin Holcomb, who sort of plays in
pianist, exactly.
In a lot of genres, but also has at least one sort of pop-ish and very-ish, heavier on the ish than the pop album. But it's a fascinating area. It just sort of reconfirms that maybe we've been too tight with labeling people.
Yeah, exactly. And when you come across someone like Hope and you don't know exactly what bin to put her in at the CD store, then what do you do? I mean, there are a lot of, you know, Amy DiNio obviously is another example, and Lori Goldston is another local example of all these, and they're, once I start naming people, I'm going to forget someone, so I probably shouldn't even, I should even avoid doing that. But there are a lot of musicians in town who are really combining vocalism and composition and instrumental performance in very interesting ways. And and again, I don't know if it is a local kind of Seattle-y thing or what people in other parts of America are doing. But
how does that affect? I mean, I believe I describe you as a composer, but in the classical genre widely. How does work like this impact people who are writing new classical music?
Well, I mean, it's just a really good example of the way that you don't have to pigeon yourself anymore. And I think there are a lot of musicians who are realizing that to kind of think of yourself strictly as folk or strictly as classical is not necessarily the most rewarding way to forge a career or to explore your own voice and explore what you want to say with music. I think that there are, once you stop thinking about those neat compartments, it probably frees you up. And an example of what Hope is doing, I mean, can serve as an example for all kinds of other musicians, I believe, who, you know, similarly should not necessarily think as in terms of pigeonholing themselves.
I'm going to spell Hope's last name so everybody get a pencil out. It's Hope Weshkin, Weshkin.
And Leaning Toward the Fiddler.
Leaning Toward the album. Gavin Borchert is a Seattle composer. He writes about music for the Seattle Weekly. And we're going to go out, I think, with one last track.
Amarilli Mia Bella. And this is Hope's arrangement of a Baroque Italian art song.
Here it is.
So combining yet another genre, another influence.
Hope Weshkin here on KUOW Seattle.
Music from Hope Weshkin on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Well, next we turn from music to geology. What we know about our next big earthquake in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
I'm Roman Alny. On the next To the Point, the upset election of a moderate cleric as the next president of Iran is getting mixed reactions. Will Hassan Rouhani be flexible on nuclear policy to improve the economy? Will he continue aid to Syria? Will he retract former President Ahmadinejad's threat to wipe Israel off the face of the earth? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
This morning at 11 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at ourparksourfuture.org.
62 degrees and partly cloudy in Seattle. Expecting showers today, maybe a thunderstorm, and an afternoon high of 71. We'll get an extended weather forecast and a suggested hike to match that forecast in about, 30 minutes or so.
It's an earthquake.
Oh, boy. We're getting you ready. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. If you have lived in the Northwest for any length of time, you've heard that the big one is coming. That's the earthquake due to hit our region sometime soon, or maybe in the next 100 years, or maybe in the next 1,000 years. Seattle Times science reporter Sandy Doughton explains what a big one might be like in her new book. It's called Full Rip 9.0. And Sandy, as I just said to you before we went on the air, this is a book that gave me one of the most vivid and chilling dreams that I've had in a long time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Some of us were here in 2001 when the Nisqually earthquake hit. It was, if I remember correctly, about a 7-ish on the Richter scale.
Yeah, 6.8.
Was that a big one?
No, that was very, very small compared to the size of earthquakes we can actually get here.
So that seemed big to me, but maybe the Fukushima. I mean, what is a big earthquake?
A big earthquake is like what we saw happen in Japan in 2011. That was a magnitude 9 earthquake that produced a massive tsunami, and that's what we can expect here.
Why can we expect that here?
Well, we can expect that here because off of our coast is a 700-mile-long fault that's called the Cascadia Subduction Zone. And this is the place where the tectonic plate that makes up the ocean floor meets the continent. And when two tectonic plates meet, something has to give. And what happens is the ocean floor sinks or subducts under the continent, but the plates get stuck as they move past each other. And when they let loose, that's an earthquake.
So what you're saying then is, as opposed to like a sandy bed of a lake that's all solid, what's underneath the oceans are things that aren't attached to one another necessarily.
Correct. The planet is divided into these massive tectonic plates. And so, there's a lot of stuff on top of those plates, like all the sediments on the seafloor and the continents, for example. But those plates are the things that move around the planet. That's what's called continental drift.
One of the things I was interested to read was that this idea of tectonic plates and subduction is actually a pretty new scientifically speaking, that I just thought this was the common wisdom for hundreds of years, but not.
No, in fact, it's only been the last 25 or 30 years that we have even realized that we are vulnerable to this kind of quake here in the Northwest, because none of them have occurred in historic times.
None of them.
Not since settlers arrived here. The last one was in the year 1700, and of course there were a lot of Native American people here and First Nations people here up in Canada, but they didn't have a written language. And so when the settlers started arriving here in, the mid-1800s, it seemed like, that this was not a bad place for earthquakes. There was an occasional small shake, but, we were nothing like California, not that bad.
And oh, how things have changed since then.
Yeah.
When did you start hunting down and putting together all the science that was going on?
Well, this is a story that I've been covering for almost 20 years as a reporter here in the Northwest. So I had, you know, I had written about bits and pieces of it, but it really wasn't until I sat down and started working on this book that that I really realized just how dramatic the shift has been and how quickly it has occurred.
You follow a lot of these, they're geologists, they're, I think I'm saying it right, paleodendrologists.
Dendrochronologists.
These are guys who study old, and women who study old tree rings.
Correct.
And look for fossils. They almost, it was like a little bit, from my perspective as a reader, like Indiana Jones. These guys are sort of out tromping around, cutting things up and diving underwater and wading through mud, looking for really weird clues.
That's true. I mean, it's like a series of detective stories where, you know, the geologist and the dendrochronologist and the geophysicist are reading the landscape for these clues that can be somewhat subtle, and they're not obvious. For example, the first evidence that these megaquakes and tsunamis occurred on the coast came from marshes out on the coast, and a geologist named Brian Atwater went out there and started digging around, and he found these layers of soil that, you know, had been at the surface at one point, and then something had happened, and they had dropped, you know, 3 or 6 feet just in an instant. And he found layer after layer after layer. And what happens in one of these great earthquakes is that when the plates that are locked together snap, the coastlines can drop abruptly. So what he found by digging under the ground was a record of these past quakes.
Why did he think that he would find that?
Well, he didn't really. It was kind of a surprise because at the time a lot of people thought that the coast would jump up during a big earthquake, because that happens in some parts of the world, but that's not the situation here. This was kind of early in the evolution of plate tectonics, so people didn't really quite appreciate how these giant quakes would play out.
So he went off to just look to see what he could find?
He went off because he thought that, you know, there was a theory at the time that this fault, the subduction zone, couldn't cause big earthquakes because the plates were just slipping smoothly past each other. And if that was the case, you know, indeed, you wouldn't get any earthquakes. The earthquakes come when the plates are stuck. But if they were slipping smoothly, then the ground would be rising gradually over time. And Brian thought that, you know, by looking at these layers of mud and sediment, that he could see if the ground had been rising. But what he found was just the opposite, that it had dropped abruptly several times in the past.
How you describe it throughout one of the it's almost sort of like those jack-in-the-boxes, that things are wound and wound and wound until something pops up.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
In this case, it's not the little happy smiling face. It's like the earth, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. The pressure builds up. And to me, one of the most stunning ways to visualize this is to look at these maps that are produced from measuring the small motions of the continent. And we do this now with GPS sensors, and there's more than 500 sensors across the Northwest. And you can look at these maps and they just show how things are moving and turning. And that really gives you a sense of just how inevitable it is. That's kind of turning the crank on that jack-in-the-box.
How much are these plates moving every year?
Well, the convergence rate between the seafloor and the continent is about 1.5 inches a year. So it's not much, but over hundreds of years, it adds up.
Well, it does seem like a lot to me, an inch and a half. You write in Japan, I think it's 3 times that, right?
It is. That's true. And as a rough rule of thumb, you know, how fast these things are moving or being compressed is an indicator of how seismically active an area is.
And so Japan then?
Japan takes the cake.
That is the most active area?
One of the most.
We're talking with Seattle Times science writer Sandy Doubt, and her book is called Full Rip 9.0, and it sounds so pleasant, but in fact, full rip means an earthquake unlike any that we've experienced in the Northwest for living people. But in 1700-ish, I'm not sure if they've pinpointed the exact year.
They've pinpointed the exact time.
How did they do that?
It's an amazing story. Basically, it has to do with the fact that in 1700, though the people living here in North America didn't have written language, people in Japan had been keeping track of earthquakes for more than 1,000 years. And a tsunami from a magnitude 9 earthquake is powerful enough to cross the Pacific Ocean. And we saw this in 2011 when the tsunami from Japan's giant quake crossed the ocean in the other direction and caused a lot of damage in Crescent City, California, and actually killed one person. So some scientists thought, well, you know, if there was a giant earthquake in the Pacific Northwest 300-400 years ago, people in Japan might have noticed. And so they started looking through these Japanese records, and indeed they found several reports from coastal villages of this, you know, night in a winter night in 1700 when water flooded ashore, and people were quite puzzled because they thought, well, it's kind of like a tsunami, but there was no earthquake. And so working from those reports, they were able to exactly date the last earthquake.
What physical evidence on this side of the ocean do we have of that earthquake?
Well, as I mentioned before, those layers of soil that were dropped abruptly are, a very good record of that. And also off the coast on the seafloor, scientists from Oregon State University have drilled out these cores. And in those cores, they see layers left by giant underwater landslides. Every time you get one of these big earthquakes, sediment that has been building up for hundreds of years on the continental shelf shakes loose, and you get these massive landslides that just, you know, roar down the slope and spill out onto the seafloor, and these cores will reveal the pattern.
And hence my nightmare of Capitol Hill sluicing down into Lake Union. But
I think Capitol Hill's pretty solid.
Do you really? That's good to hear. One of the things that I'm curious about is there's evidence of all these megaquakes here. Why does California have the reputation as the place where earthquakes are going to be?
Well, they happen more often in California because, you know, when we go back to this convergence rate or the rate at which, you know, plates are being squeezed and moving, it's a little bit higher in California. So they get them more often, but they don't get them as big as we're going to get here.
They're not going to get a megaquake there.
No. I mean, it depends on how you define a megaquake, but they will not get a magnitude 9 quake. The biggest quakes in the world are produced by these offshore subduction zone faults.
So is there a difference between a subduction zone and a fault?
A subduction zone is a kind of fault.
Another question I had was the difference between a deep earthquake and a shallow earthquake. The Nisqually quake was 30 miles down. That seems deep. Am I right about that?
Yeah, we actually get three types of earthquakes here. We really hit the earthquake jackpot in the Northwest.
Oh, good.
So in addition to these coastal megaquakes on the subduction zone, we also get these deep earthquakes like the Nisqually quake that happen, like you said, 30, 40 miles below ground, and that kind of blunts the impact. So that's, you know, one of the main reasons why the damage from that Nisqually quake wasn't more severe than it was. And then we also have a series of shallow faults, and these are California-style faults, kind of like, you know, small San Andreas faults that run through our urban areas, and one of those runs right under Seattle. And so a quake on that fault right under Seattle would be particularly damaging because it's right here. It's right under our feet.
But not a megaquake.
No, it wouldn't be. It wouldn't qualify as a megaquake, but it would be pretty, the damage would be pretty mega here in Seattle.
Well, I'm thinking about hundreds or so years ago, the great San Francisco earthquake. What kind of earthquake was that?
That was an earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. So it was a shallow fault earthquake, and that's the type of quake we can expect someday on the Seattle Fault.
Now, these earthquakes are not confined to Western Washington. If we're just talking about our state, Eastern Washington is equally at risk and has a history.
Yeah, it's probably not equally at risk, but it's sort of like the comparison between us and California. I think Western Washington is being squeezed more, and therefore our rate of earthquakes is a little bit higher, but Eastern Washington is being squeezed too. And there have been some very big earthquakes over there. There was a really big earthquake in 1872. That, you know, people estimate at up to magnitude 7 or so.
When did scientists have the tools to measure the severity of earthquakes?
There are many different ways to measure severity. And there are a number of scales.
It's not just the Richter scale.
It's not the Richter scale. There are a number of scales. The Richter scale attempts to measure the relative strength of an earthquake. But there are a number of older scales that that gauge the power of an earthquake based on what people experience. Mm-hmm. And so if windows break, you know, that's a certain rating. If buildings fall down, that's another rating. And it's kind of funny, the very top rating on this Mercalli scale is called total destruction.
And is that what the Fukushima quake was? Because it wasn't total destruction.
It wasn't total destruction because Japan is very well built. But as you saw, the areas where in the areas where the tsunami hit, the destruction was total.
What is the correlation between a tsunami and the quake itself?
Well, when these plates that are locked together snap, you get the plate, the continental plate, the edge of it kind of flips up, mm-hmm. and that plate is underwater. And so when it flips up, that flipping up creates the tsunami. So it pushes up the water column, and that water comes rushing toward shore.
So, for example, if you live in Magnolia or West Seattle, are you going to feel the impact of a tsunami because you're sort of on the water?
The tsunami from a coastal megaquake will—the damage from that tsunami will be mostly out on the coast. The tsunami will probably come down the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but by the time it gets to Puget Sound, it's not going to cause any significant damage. But what could happen here is during one of those quakes, you could get the shaking causing underwater landslides. And so when you have an underwater landslide, you could have a local tsunami. And we could also get tsunamis here from an earthquake on the Seattle Fault.
So I'm going to be totally egocentric and talk about the central Puget Sound region from Everett through Tacoma or maybe down to Olympia. What areas might experience more damage than others in a Seattle Fault earthquake?
Well, in a Seattle Fault earthquake, the worst damage will be here in Seattle and probably continuing on into Bellevue, Issaquah, and in the other direction toward Bremerton.
So through the central part of the city itself?
Some people say it's kind of surprising that people still don't really know exactly where the Seattle Fault is. But the consensus is that it kind of passes south of the city through the Soto area down by the stadiums.
So is that why the Nisqually quake damage was sort of Pioneer Square south, the main damage?
Well, the reason the main damage was down there in the case of the Nisqually quake is because, number one, there are a lot of old brick buildings there, which are, you know, perhaps the most dangerous structures that exist. And the city of Seattle has recently put together an inventory of about 100 potentially dangerous brick buildings in this city. So that's one reason the damage was concentrated there. And another is the fact that that is loose soil. That area was filled in about 100 years ago. And so areas of loose soil always shake harder in an earthquake.
Sandy Doughton's our guest. She's a Seattle Times science writer. Her book is called full rip 9.0. There is another fault, and it's called the South Whidbey Island fault, but it's bigger than South Whidbey Island. If you want to talk about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, correct. That is the largest of our shallow faults in the state of Washington, and it's a pretty big thing. It runs from Vancouver Island, the city of Victoria, and recently scientists have tracked it all the way over to Richland in the Tri-Cities. So it's a very, very massive fault. Now, they don't think that it will rip all at once. They think that when it rips...
Good to hear.
Yes, exactly, because that would be a pretty big quake. But they think it will probably rip in segments, and they have found evidence of several past quakes on that fault.
A group of Canadian scientists recently issued a report sort of reconfirming again that we're due for another mega quake, but due is sort of relative. I mean, does that mean 10 days? Does that mean 10 years? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, due is a human term, and if earthquakes were like babies, they would have a set gestation period, and then we could say, yes, indeed, a quake is overdue. But unfortunately, they don't. They happen on a really kind of sporadic schedule. We do know that in the past 10,000 years, there's well-documented evidence for 19 of these full rip 9 or bigger megaquakes. So that pencils out to one every 500 years. The most recent evidence coming out of Oregon is that there were at least that many, maybe a few more, slightly smaller quakes of magnitude 8 in that same time period. So if you lump those all together, then that comes out, then the average is that we get one of these pretty big quakes every 250 years or so. And it's been 313 years since the last one.
Is there any way, any kind of measurement that seismologists or geologists are using to, I mean, hurricane trackers see it. What do Earth scientists do?
Oh, they wish they could see it, but they can't. They just...
There's no way to predict it.
There is still no way to predict it, absolutely none.
Can they look at activity at Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, Shasta, any of the volcanoes? Is there a correlation? There must be a correlation between volcanic activity and seismologic activity.
There is a link. Usually it goes the other way, that earthquakes will trigger volcanic eruptions. That's happened a few times that have been fairly well documented. And, you know, there are some people who suggest that the next Cascadia quake, you know, could set off some activity at our volcanoes. But really, you know, if there was a reliable way to predict earthquakes, we would be doing it, and there isn't.
I have to say, reading this book, aside from giving me nightmares, made me wonder where I should move to be free of this. Is this, the coast is out, pretty much the whole West Coast. Does the East Coast also, are they looking at tectonic plate activity and subduction zone activity as well?
Well, the East Coast isn't nearly, you know, as seismologically active as the West Coast. So if you're really afraid of earthquakes, you could move there. But, you know, there was an earthquake not far from Washington, D.C. not long ago. You know, every place has its own hazards. And I don't think the fact that we're subject to earthquakes should, you know, lead to a mass exodus from the Pacific Northwest. What we should do is, you know, take this information and just get ready.
And we're going to talk more about that in the next hour of the show, so you can be more, or at least try to be, as ready as you can. But I have to just stop and talk about one really cool thing. There are a lot of cool things. I get the sense that these scientists are totally gleeful when they're out there shoveling and digging. But under Lake Washington, an incredibly deep lake, there's an entire buried forest. And I think there were many cool facts I read, but this was the one that for some reason really caught my imagination. Can you talk a little bit about what caused that?
Yeah, that's just an amazing story. People who have lived on Lake Washington for a long time have known about these drowned forests because, you know, occasionally boats would get hung up in them and, you know, people would lose fishing lines and anchors, et cetera. So they knew these trees were down there. And people sort of looked up at the shoreline and could see these huge divots in the shoreline. And they put two and two together and concluded that these were forests that had slid into the lake carried by massive landslides. And it was when people were studying the Seattle Fault that researchers finally went out there and dove down and tried to, you know, cut sections out of these trees to look at the tree rings and date when they fell into the lake. And eventually they were able to do that. It's a pretty interesting and complicated story, but they got some good sections, and they dated that the demise of those forests to about 1,100 years ago, and that matched up with other dates from around the region of when the Seattle Fault last ripped. So that was the date of the last Seattle Fault earthquake, and it caused those huge forests of old-growth cedar and fir to just slide into Lake Washington.
So it gives you some sense of what could happen when the next big one rips here.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy Doughton, science writer for the Seattle Times. Her new book is called Full Rip 9.0. She's going to be speaking tonight at 7 at the Central Library in downtown Seattle. We're going to talk more about how you can prepare for a megaquake or any earthquake. That's coming up in the next hour on Weekday. Thank you, Sandy, for coming in.
Thank you, Marcy.
Ooh, well, now you can all be shaken in your shoes. But perhaps before the big one comes, you want to get outside. And Michael Fagan is with us once again to tell us where we can get into the great outdoors. I guess, Michael, maybe it's going to be a good week for walking.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting week weather-wise. We're not looking at any big one, at least not in the forecast I'm looking at. The weather theme is we have a trough of low pressure that'll be off the coast. And with this, we can expect a chance of some rain on and off. Today is actually the best day out of the next several. A chance of some afternoon thunder showers for Tuesday and Wednesday, so be aware of that. And might get some steady rain on Thursday, so looks a little wet. And then Friday and Saturday should dry out. Now, our hike, what's good about this hike, it is good rain or shine. It's Packwood Lake, which bit of a drive. It's south of Rainier, but it's a really nice area. It's 10 miles round trip, and so it has a fair amount of mileage, but very little elevation gain, 600-foot gain. I was told by several KUOW listeners to suggest a hike that's easy on my knees. Not
I'm with them.
Yeah, so this on a Marcy scale for steepness, this is just a one or two, so we give you a break with that. This hike is good rain or shine. It's most of the hike's under a thick forest canopy, so if it is raining, you'll stay dry somewhat. And if you want the views, like I mentioned, Friday and Saturday are best for that. And once you get to the lake, and you'll see on the blog, it's just stunning views of Packwood Lake. You have Johnson Peak in the background. And also along the hike, you can see some really nice views of Mount Rainier. And then also at the lake, there's an old guard station built in 1910, so it's very interesting. And you'll need a forest pass, and it's Green Trails Map 302, so that's a very fun trip.
How far south of Mount Rainier is this?
If you know where Ohana Pekash campground is, I'd say maybe 20, 25 minutes south of there. So from Bellevue area is a benchmark. I'd say it's about two and a half hour drive. So you want to certainly give it a full day. Now, if you're looking for a shorter hike, I just read a trip report that Tallapus Lake by Snoqualmie Pass is snow-free. So if you're looking for something shorter in, driving-wise, if you're in the Seattle area, Telepus Lake is a good one, or, of course, Tiger Mountain as well.
But this is essentially, this is a day trip, a nice, for me, for those of us with older knees, 10 miles around the lake, but relatively steep-free.
Yeah, steep-free. That's a good term. It's a 600-foot elevation gain, so that's, around here, that's hard to do, and this hike is really a lot of fun. And it's if you have kids, it's a great hike for kids too, because they like flat as well.
But this would be, it's probably a little late to start on it today, but you're saying that this is the best day weather-wise for the next three or so.
Right. So if you're looking for a hike today, and do be aware, there's a chance of some thunder showers this afternoon, especially in the mountains. So you want to be aware of, come 4 or 5 o'clock, of looking at the cloud build up. So a close-in hike, little size, a nice one if you want to break out of work early and get some exercise.
Michael, thank you so much.
You bet. Talk to you next week.
Okay. Michael Fagans with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagans Weather World, gives us some good hikes to match the weekend weather forecast and the week weather forecast, off and on showers. And he suggests we head up to Packwood Lake south of Mount Rainier, where you'll be under the tree canopy. And now, the sound of the day. It's a dog pack. Our listener Dale sent this sound in. He was at Magnuson Park in the off-leash area, and a man brought 6 dogs through the double gates, and those dogs were very, very excited to be at the park. And if you've ever gone there, there's a big, big dog field where everybody starts running immediately, and then there's the little dog field just next door, and all the dogs, Bernard, are equally happy.
It's madness.
It is.
I have been there.
It's canine madness. Well, summer's about to begin, and with summers comes barking dogs, vacations, day trips, barbecues, all kinds of interesting sounds outside and inside. And we want to hear the sound of your summer activities in particular. What are you listening to? What are you hearing? Maybe it's the pack of dogs, or maybe it's a fish swishing around on your reel. Record 30 seconds and send that sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. And as I mentioned, Bernard, now that everybody's all wound up about the megaquake that is due any minute, we're going to hear how we might prepare for that.
That sounds like an excellent idea.
You're ready, aren't you? Ready to go?
I will be soon.
You will be soon? Well, all of us will be, so stay tuned.
Yes. It's 9:59. Italy's highest court has overturned the murder acquittal of Seattle's Amanda Knox. We'll find out why in the news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Virginia Mason's Floyd and Dolores Jones Cancer Institute, currently offering more than 40 clinical research studies for cancer patients. Learn more online at virginiamason.org/cancer.
In a lab, under a microscope, there's a feather.
Maybe it's a bird of prey or a pigeon or a dove.
It's from the stomach of a Burmese python, a species invading Florida's Everglades.
We can go to work on identifying the birds that this nasty snake has been eating.
Think of it as CSI Everglades on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from KCTS9, presenting Coal, a documentary about the debate over building coal export terminals in the Northwest. KCTS9 and EarthFix follow coal's path from Wyoming's open-pit mines to the proposed ports. Coal premieres Wednesday night at 7:30 on KCTS9 and online.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.